Interesting Times by Terry Pratchett, read by Nigel Planer. This is where the gods play games with the lives of men. On a board which is at one and the same time a simple playing area and the whole world. And fate always wins. Fate always wins. Most of the gods throw dice, but fate plays chess. And you don't find out until too late that he's been using two queens all along. Fate wins. At least, so it is claimed. Whatever happens, they say afterwards, it must have been fate. People are always a little confused about this, as they are in the case of miracles. When someone is saved from certain death by a strange concatenation of circumstances, they say, that's a miracle. But of course, if someone is killed by a freak chain of events, the oil spilled just there, the safety fence broken just there, that must also be a miracle. Just because it's not nice doesn't mean it's not miraculous. Gods can take any form, but the one aspect of themselves they cannot change is their eyes, which show their nature. The eyes of fate are hardly eyes at all, just dark holes into an infinity speckled with what may be stars, or there again, maybe other things. He blinked them, smiled at his fellow players in the smug way winners do just before they become winners, and said, "I accuse the high priest of the green robe in the library with the double-handed axe." And he won. He beamed at them. "No one likes a poor winner," grumbled Offler the crocodile god through his fangs. "It seems that I am favouring myself today," said Fate. "Anyone fancy something else?" The gods shrugged. "Mad kings," said Fate pleasantly. "Star-crossed lovers?"
"I think we've lost the rules for that one," said blind Io, chief of the gods.
"Or tempest-wrecked mariners."
"You always win," said Io.
"Floods and droughts," said Fate. "That's an easy one."
A shadow fell across the gaming table. The gods looked up.
"Ah," said Fate.
"Let a game begin," said the lady.
There was always an argument about whether the newcomer was a goddess at all. Certainly no one ever got anywhere by worshipping her, and she tended to turn up only when she was least expected, such as now. And people who trusted in her seldom survived. Any temples built to her would surely be struck by lightning. Better to juggle axes on a tightrope than say her name. Just call her the waitress in the Last Chance Saloon. She was generally referred to as the lady, and her eyes were green. Not as the eyes of humans are green, but emerald green from edge to edge. It was said to be her favourite colour.
"Ah," said Fate again. "And what game will it be?"
She sat down opposite him. The watching gods looked sidelong at one another. This looked interesting. These two were ancient enemies.
"How about," she paused, "mighty empires?"
"Oh, I hate that one," said Offler, breaking the sudden silence. "Everyone dies at the end."
"Yes," said Fate, "I believe they do."
He nodded at the lady, and in much the same voice as professional gamblers say, "aces high," said, "the fall of great houses? Destinies of nations hanging by a thread?"
"Certainly," she said.
"Oh, good."
Fate waved a hand across the board. The disc world appeared.
"And where shall we play?" he said.
"The counterweight continent," said the lady, "where five noble families have fought one another for centuries."
"Really? Which families are these?"
said Io. He had little involvement with individual humans. He generally looked after thunder and lightning, so from his point of view the only purpose of humanity was to get wet, or, in occasional cases, charred.
"The Hongs, the Sungs, the Tangs, the McSweeneys, and the Fangs."
"Them? I didn't know they were noble," said Io.
They're all very rich, and have had millions of people butchered or tortured to death merely for reasons of expediency and pride, said the lady.
The watching gods nodded solemnly. That was certainly noble behaviour. That was exactly what they would have done.
McQueenie, said Offler.
A very old established family, said Fate.
Oh.
And they wrestle one another for the Empire, said Fate. Very good. Which will you be?
The lady looked at the history stretched out in front of them.
The Hongs are the most powerful. Even as we speak, they have taken yet more cities, she said. I see they are fated to win.
So, no doubt you'll pick a weaker family.
Fate waved his hand again. The playing pieces appeared and started to move around the board as if they had a life of their own, which was, of course, the case.
But, he said, we shall play without dice. I don't trust you with dice. You throw them where I can't see them. We will play with steel, and tactics, and politics, and war.
The lady nodded. Fate looked across at his opponent.
And your move? He said.
She smiled.
I've already made it.
He looked down.
But I don't see your pieces on the board.
They're not on the board yet, she said.
She opened her hand. There was something black and yellow on her palm. She blew on it, and it unfolded its wings. It was a butterfly. Fate always wins. At least, when people stick to the rules. According to the philosopher Li Tin Weedle, chaos is found in greatest abundance wherever order is being sought. It always defeats order because it's better organized. This is the butterfly of the storms. See the wings, slightly more ragged than those of the common fritillary. In reality, thanks to the fractal nature of the universe, this means that those ragged edges are infinite, in the same way that the edge of any rugged coastline, when measured to the ultimate microscopic level, is infinitely long, or if not infinite, then at least so close to it that infinity can be seen on a clear day. And therefore, if their edges are infinitely long, the wings must logically be infinitely big. They may look about the right size for a butterfly's wings, but that's only because human beings have always preferred common sense to logic. The quantum weather butterfly, Papilio tempestae, is an undistinguished yellow colour, although the Mandelbrot patterns on the wings are of considerable interest. Its outstanding feature is its ability to create weather. This presumably began as a survival trait, since even an extremely hungry bird would find itself inconvenienced by a nasty, localised tornado. Usually about 6 inches across. From there, it possibly became a secondary sexual characteristic, like the plumage of birds or the throat sacs of certain frogs. Look at me, the male says, flapping his wings lazily in the canopy of the rainforest. I may be an undistinguished yellow colour, but in a fortnight's time, 1,000 miles away, freak gales cause road chaos. This is the butterfly of the storms. It flaps its wings. This is the Discworld, which goes through space on the back of a giant turtle. Most worlds do, at some time in their perception. It's a cosmological view the human brain seems pre-programmed to take. On veldt and plain, in cloud jungle and silent red desert, in swamp and reed marsh, in fact, in any place where something goes plop off a floating log as you approach, variations on the following take place, at a crucial early point in the development of the tribal mythology.
You see that?
What?
It just went plop off that log.
Yeah, well,
I reckon the world is carried on the back of one of them.
A moment of silence while the astrophysical hypothesis is considered, and then...
The whole world? Of course, when I say one of them, I mean a big one of them. It'd have to be, yeah. Like, really big.
It's funny, but I see what you mean.
Makes sense, right?
Makes sense, yeah. Thing is...
What?
I just hope it never goes plop.
But this is the Discworld, which has not only the turtle, but also the four giant elephants on which the wide, slowly turning wheel of the world revolves. People wonder how this works, since a terrestrial elephant would be unlikely to bear a revolving load for any length of time without some serious friction burns.
But you may as well ask why the axle of a planet doesn't squeak, or where love goes, or what sound yellow makes.
There is the Circle Sea, approximately halfway between the hub and the rim. Around it are those countries which, according to history, constitute the civilized world, i.e. a world that can support historians. Ephebe, Tussaut, Omnia, Klatch, and the sprawling city-state of Ankh-Morpork. This is a story that starts somewhere else, where a man is lying on a raft in a blue lagoon under a sunny sky. His head is resting on his arms. He is happy. In his case, a mental state so rare as to be almost unprecedented. He is whistling an amiable little tune and dangling his feet in the crystal clear water. They are pink feet with 10 toes that look like little piggywiggies. From the point of view of a shark skimming over the reef, they look like lunch, dinner, and tea. It was, as always, a matter of protocol, of discretion, of careful etiquette, of, ultimately, alcohol, or at least the illusion of alcohol. Lord Vetinari, as supreme ruler of Ankh-Morpork, could in theory summon the Arch-Chancellor of Unseen University to his presence, and indeed have him executed if he failed to obey. On the other hand, Mustrum Ridcully, as head of the College of Wizards, had made it clear in polite but firm ways that he could turn him into a small amphibian, and indeed start jumping around the room on a pogo stick. Alcohol bridged the diplomatic gap nicely. Sometimes Lord Vetinari invited the Arch-Chancellor to the palace for a convivial drink, and of course the Arch-Chancellor went, because it would be bad manners not to. And everyone understood the position, and everyone was on their best behaviour, and thus civil unrest and slime on the carpet were averted. It was a beautiful afternoon. Lord Vetinari was sitting in the palace gardens, watching the butterflies with an expression of mild annoyance. He found something very slightly offensive about the way they just fluttered around, enjoying themselves in an unprofitable way. He looked up.
"Ah, Arch-Chancellor," he said. "So good to see you. Do sit down. I trust you are well."
"Yes, indeed," said Mustrum Ridcully. "And yourself? You are in good health?"
"Never better. The weather, I see, has turned out nice again."
"I thought yesterday was particularly fine, certainly."
"Tomorrow, I am told, could well be even better."
"We could certainly do with a fine spell."
"Yes, indeed."
"Yes."
"Ah."
"Certainly."
They watched the butterflies. A butler brought long, cool drinks.
"What is it they actually do with the flowers?"
said Lord Vetinari.
"What?"
The patrician shrugged.
"Never mind. It was not at all important. But since you are here, Arch-Chancellor, having dropped by on your way to something infinitely more important, I am sure most kind, I wonder if you could tell me, who is the great wizard?"
Ridcully considered this.
"The dean, possibly," he said. "He must be all of 20 stone.
"Somehow I feel that is not perhaps the right answer," said Lord Vetinari. "I suspect from context that great means superior."
"Ah, not the dean, then," said Ridcully.
Lord Vetinari tried to recollect the Faculty of Unseen University. The mental picture that emerged was of a small range of foothills in pointy hats.
"The context does not, I feel, suggest the dean," he said.
"What context would this be?"
said Ridcully. The patrician picked up his walking stick.
"Come this way," he said. "I suppose you had better see for yourself. It is very vexing."
Ridcully looked around with interest as he followed Lord Vetinari. He did not often have the chance to see the gardens, which had been written up in the How Not to Do It section of gardening manuals everywhere. They had been laid out, and a truer phrase was never used, by the renowned or at least notorious landscape gardener and all-round inventor, bloody stupid Johnson, whose absent-mindedness and blindness to elementary mathematics made every step a walk with danger. His genius, well, as far as Ridcully understood it, his genius was exactly the opposite of whatever kind of genius it was that built earthworks, that tapped the secret yet beneficent forces of the ley lines. No one was quite certain what forces Bloody Stupid's designs tapped, but the chiming sundial frequently exploded, the crazy paving had committed suicide, and the cast-iron garden furniture was known to have melted on three occasions. The patrician led the way through a gate and into something like a dovecot. A creaking wooden stairway led around the inside. A few of Ankh Morpork's indestructible feral pigeons muttered and sniggered in the shadows.
"What's this?" said Ridcully, as the stairs groaned under him.
The patrician took a key out of his pocket.
"I have always understood that Mr. Johnson originally planned this to be a beehive," he said. "However, in the absence of bees 10 feet long, we have found other uses."
He unlocked a door to a wide square room with a big unglazed window in each wall. Each rectangle was surrounded by a wooden arrangement to which was affixed a bell on a spring. It was apparent that anything large enough entering by one of the windows would cause the bell to ring. In the centre of the room, standing on a table, was the largest bird Ridcully had ever seen. It turned and fixed him with a beady yellow eye. The patrician reached into a pocket and took out a jar of anchovies.
"This one caught us rather unexpectedly," he said. "It must be almost 10 years since a message last arrived. We used to keep a few fresh mackerel on ice."
"Isn't that a pointless albatross?" said Ridcully.
"Indeed," said Lord Vetinari, "and a highly trained one. It will return this evening. 6,000 miles on one jar of anchovies and a bottle of fish paste my clerk Drumknot found in the kitchens. Amazing."
I'm sorry," said Ridcully.
Return to where?"
Lord Vetinari turned to face him.
"Not, let me make it clear, to the counterweight continent," he said. "This is not one of those birds the Agatean Empire uses for its message service. It is a well-known fact that we have no contact with that mysterious land. And this bird is not the first to arrive here for many years, and it did not bring a strange and puzzling message. Do I make myself clear?"
No.
"Good.
This is not an albatross."
The patrician smiled.
"Ah, I can see you're getting the hang of it."
Mustrum Ridcully, though possessed of a large and efficient brain, was not at home with duplicity. He looked at the long, vicious beak.
"Looks like a bloody albatross to me," he said.
"And you just said it was. I said, isn't that a—" The patrician waved a hand irritably.
"Leaving aside our ornithological studies," he said, "the point is that this bird had in its message pouch the following piece of paper."
"You mean, did not have the following piece of paper?" said Ridcully, struggling for a grip.
"Ah, yes, yes, of course. That is what I mean. And this isn't it. Observe."
He handed a single small sheet to the Arch-Chancellor.
"Looks like a painting," said Ridcully. "Those are Agatean pictograms," said the patrician.
"You mean they're not Agatean pictograms?"
"Yes, yes, certainly," sighed the patrician. "I can see you are well alongside the essential business of diplomacy. Now, your views, please."
"Looks like slosh, 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 wizard," said Ridcully.
"And from that you deduce?"
"He took art because he wasn't any good at spelling.
I mean, who wrote it? Painted it, I mean."
"I don't know. The Grand Viziers used to send the occasional message, but I gather there has been some turmoil in recent years. It is unsigned, you notice. However, I cannot ignore it.
Wizard.
The
wizard, said Ridcully thoughtfully.
The pictograms mean, send us instantly the great, said Lord Vetinari.
Wizard, said Ridcully to himself, tapping the paper. The patrician tossed an anchovy to the albatross, which swallowed it greedily.
The Empire has 1 million men under arms, he said. Happily it suits the rulers to pretend that everywhere outside the Empire is a valueless howling waste, peopled only by vampires and ghosts. They usually have no interest whatsoever in our affairs. This is fortunate for us because they are both cunning, rich, and powerful. Frankly, I had hoped they had forgotten about us altogether. And now this. I was hoping to be able to dispatch the wretched person and forget about it.
Wizard, said Ridcully.
Perhaps you would like a holiday, said the patrician, a hint of hope in his voice.
Me?
Can't abide foreign food, said Ridcully quickly. He repeated half to himself.
Wizard.
The word seems to fascinate you, said Lord Vetinari.
Seen it spelled like that before, said Ridcully. Can't remember where.
I'm sure you will remember, and will be in a position to send the great wizard, however he is spelled, to the Empire by tea time.
Ridcully's jaw dropped. 6,000 miles? By magic? Do you know how hard that is?
I cherish my ignorance on the subject, said Lord Vetinari.
Besides, Ridcully went on, they're foreign over there. I thought they had enough wizards of their own.
I really couldn't say.
We don't know why they want this wizard?
No. But I'm sure there is someone you could spare. There seems to be such a lot of you down there.
I mean, it could be for some terrible foreign purpose, said Ridcully. For some reason, the face of the Dean waddled across his mind, and he brightened up.
They might be happy with a great wizard, do you think? He mused. I leave that entirely to you. But by tonight I would like to be able to send back a message saying that the great wizard is duly on his way, and then we can forget about it.
Of course it would be very hard to bring the chap back, said Ridcully. He thought of the Dean again. Practically impossible, he added, in an inappropriately happy way. I expect we'd try for months and months without succeeding. I expect we'd attempt everything with no luck. Damn it.
I can see you are agog to rise to this challenge, said the patrician. Let me not detain you from rushing back to the university and putting measures in hand.
But wizard, Ridcully murmured. Rings a faint bell, that. Think I've seen it before somewhere. The shark didn't think much. Sharks don't. Their thought processes can largely be represented by equals. You see it, equals, you eat it. But as it arrowed through the waters of the lagoon, its tiny brain began to receive little packages of salation, existential dread that could only be called doubts. It knew it was the biggest shark around. All the challengers had fled, or run up against the good old equals. Yet its body told it that something was coming up fast behind it. It turned gracefully, and the first thing it saw was hundreds of legs and thousands of toes. A whole pork pie factory of piggywiggies. Many things went on at Unseen University, and regrettably teaching had to be one of them. The faculty had long ago confronted this fact, and had perfected various devices for avoiding it. But this was perfectly all right, because to be fair, so had the students. The system worked quite well, and as happens in such cases, had taken on the status of a tradition. Lectures clearly took place, because they were down there on the timetable in black and white. The fact that no one attended was an irrelevant detail. It was occasionally maintained that this meant that the lectures did not in fact happen at all, but no one ever attended them to find out if this was true. Anyway, it was argued by the reader in woolly thinking, which is like fuzzy logic, only less so, that lectures had taken place in essence, so that was all right too. And therefore, education at the university mostly worked by the age-old method of putting a lot of young people in the vicinity of a lot of books and hoping that something would pass from one to the other, while the actual young people put themselves in the vicinity of inns and taverns for exactly the same reason. It was the middle of the afternoon. The chair of indefinite studies was giving a lecture in room 3B, and therefore his presence asleep in front of the fire in the uncommon room was a technicality upon which no diplomatic man would comment. Ridcully kicked him on the shins. "Ow!"
"Sorry to interrupt, chair," said Ridcully in a very perfunctory way. "God's help me, I need the Council of Wizards. Where is everybody?"
The chair of indefinite studies rubbed his legs.
"I know the lecturer in recent runes is giving a lecture in 3B, he said, "but I don't know where he is. You know, that really hurt."
All virtual lectures took place in room 3B, a room not locatable on any floor plan of the university, and also it was considered infinite in size.
"Round everyone up. My study, 10 minutes, said Ridcully. He was a great believer in this approach. A less direct arch-chancellor would have wandered around looking for everyone. His policy was to find one person and make their life difficult until everything happened the way he wanted it to, a policy adopted by almost all managers and several notable gods.